Well, it has been a real treat to be here for me, and the presentations especially, not only in the evening, but the ones that I've been able to sit in on in the concurrent sessions have just been tremendously encouraging. Now, this morning, I want to talk for a few minutes, and then we're going to have a Q&A. If you have some Q, I'll try to have some A. We want to conclude our discussion talking about worship and holiness. Now, the reason we want to do this is because everything else we say really comes to a head in who we are. And that is the bottom line. Because if we're just talking a fine line about stuff, it's not going to mean much. What the world wants to see is the integrity of a life lived in God. And until we come to that point, there really is little force to what we'll do. We may have something to say that's attractive and maybe even more attractive than all the other voices that are heard on campus, because frankly the competition is not all that hot in terms of attractiveness. We don't have a lot of good news in this world. But the real question is, can we deliver transformed character? Can we deliver a life lived in the power of God? And those go together. God in His mercy normally prevents us from having more power than we can stand. And whether or not we can stand it depends on our character. So the real issue is holiness. Now, holiness is a kind of an old-fashioned term, isn't it? Probably wouldn't be the first word that you would use in talking about your faith as a Christian to a non-Christian on campus. And in fact, we've rather lost the term in our churches generally. I mean, what does holiness mean today? For example, in discussing the CEOs that are currently in the news, probably the issue of holiness would not be brought up with reference to them. There would be an incongruity somehow. It wouldn't fit together. But I would like to tell you that that's really the issue. And the problem with all that we see in our common life on the universities and outside is we don't aim high enough. And what is called professional ethics in this country today is pitiful. It's pitiful. And doesn't begin to remotely come close to what is needed for human beings. And so we just need to understand that. We have to deal with who we are, and we have to put the objective high enough that will pull such beings as we are together and make us fully functional. That make any sense? See, the problem with the folks who are in trouble, I don't mean to prejudge any of them. I mean, it really, I have students who actually think that people are innocent until they're proven guilty. As if somehow proving guilty made them guilty. And if perhaps not being proved guilty meant they were innocent, you know. So, but there's a point to it, and I don't mean to prejudge these. But there's some serious problems here. And the problem is these people who have betrayed so many others by their wrongdoing are not fully functioning human beings. They are not what their nature calls them to be. It's just that simple. And holiness is a matter of becoming a fully functioning human being. That's what holiness is. Now, if you have trouble with that, probably it's because you don't have a high enough view of what a human being is. And I'd just like to take you back to our little handouts, page 3. Don't worry about the screams or anything. We'll get by, and you get to listen this time instead of having to punch buttons over there. Just go back to page 3 there, and you'll remember there on the fourth screen, the good person, a matter of the heart. And I described there, and we've been over that, but now I want to go deeper into it, see. So move down to the last screen on the left there, the mature life of light, of love, truth, and power. And let's look at that just a moment, because that's what holiness is. It is love made perfect in community. Now, Paul had this way of putting it in 2 Corinthians 6 and opening of 7, where he talks about the call of the human being to be the dwelling place of God. Now, that's what I am supposed to be where I am. That's what I'm supposed to be when I walk into a class, when I live with my colleagues, when I carry out my life in my community and in my family, see. Quoting here in verse 16 from the Old Testament, he says, I will dwell in them and walk among them. I will be their God and they will be my people. Therefore, come out from their midst and be separate. I will welcome you. I will be a father to you. You will be sons and daughters to me, says the Lord Almighty. Now, of course, Paul didn't put in the chapter division, did he? So go on to the next verse. Therefore. Now, the therefore is there to refer back to what was just said. Therefore, having these promises, what were the promises? That God would dwell in them. Having those promises, beloved, let us cleanse ourselves from the defilement of the flesh and spirit. Now, the defilements, frankly, that we are most challenged with are defilements of spirit. The defilements of the non-physical side. The degradation of intellect and art, and technology. See, that's spiritual. You know, Satan primarily works in the realm of ideas. That's where he worked. Because he knows if he gets that, he's got a whole segment of humanity. He didn't hit Eve with a stick. Right? He hit her with an idea. That's where the real battle is. And the defilement of ideas, the degradation of the arts in our world is such a triumph of Satan. And of course, we've had jokes about academic freedom, but of course, freedom is the watchword there again, isn't it? In the arts. You ought to be able to do anything. You ought to be able to see anything. In the name of creativity and artistic life. See, that's an idea that the devil has brought upon a culture that has as one of its goals the pursuit of happiness. That's one of the illusions. These illusions come in many forms. They used to run an ad for Peugeots in Los Angeles paper for many years. It said, pursue happiness in a car that can catch it. Well, no, never mind that there were hundreds of thousands of miserable Peugeot drivers. Right? See, it's just the ideas that keep coming. Therefore, having these promises, beloved, let us cleanse ourselves from all defilement of flesh and spirit, perfecting holiness in the fear of God. Now you see therefore reference back to the previous verses. So you can't understand, go back to my page 3 there, you can't understand holiness without understanding who you are. And now that last screen on that page, who you are and why you're here. And I want to focus your attention now on that wording for a moment. You are a never-ceasing spiritual being with an eternal destiny in God's great universe. That's who you are. I am an unceasing spiritual being with an eternal destiny in God's great universe. Can you say that? Would you say it with me? I am an unceasing spiritual being with an eternal destiny in God's great universe. That's who I am. Now, would you say it to a person near you? You are. Could you do that? You are an unceasing spiritual being with an eternal destiny in God's great universe. Now that's what our life is about. I often say to my students, what if it turns out you can't stop existing? And they're all sitting there thinking about holding on to existence. What if it turned out you couldn't get rid of it? Well, Mickey Mantle, you remember, said, if I'd known I was going to live so long, I'd have taken better care of myself. Well, how do you take care of yourself if you realize you're never going to stop existing? See, holiness is an inner condition. It's an inner condition. Holiness is not an external action. And that one of the things that gave it such a bad name was it was turned into external actions and made into legalisms, primarily by which you judge other people. And that, by the way, is one of the roots in the religious past of this country for the tremendous rejection of judgment in our time. It's interesting. It's a perverted Christian root. And so much that we see around us is like that. Tolerance, for example. You don't find tolerance discussed except in a post-Christian society. I mean, go to Saudi Arabia and see how much discussion of tolerance you have. Or for that matter, India, which often is presented as a tolerant society because of the language about tolerance. You see, it's the vision of who we are that lays the foundation for holiness. And holiness is the transformation of the inner person in such a way that the deeds and words of Christ naturally flow from that inner condition. That's why Jesus said, my yoke is easy, my burden is light. Holiness is not hard. Acting holy when you're not is impossible. Right? That's different. But we're not talking about acting holy. We're talking about being holy. And Christ calls us into his life. He gives us redemption. He gives us transformation. The blood of Jesus Christ, God's Son, cleanseth us from all sin. Would you notice that that didn't say from all guilt? Now, you know, don't get worried about perfection. You'll have a few months before you need to worry about that. This is transformation. He breaks the power of canceled sin. Canceled sin has power. Transformation of character is holiness. And when you realize that who you are, and then you receive the love of God, go back to the little screen on the left. You see the way the arrows run. We love God because he first loved us. Right? So then you make the circle, and here you just need to study 1 John and see how he treats love, and you'll see this. Our love goes back to God. And then, as John says, he who loves, he who begot, loves who is begotten of him. Right? So the community of love, through God we love others. And that love comes back to us from others in the community of love. One nation under God. What would that really look like? This is what it would look like. And the wonderful songs, our patriotic songs, all talk about this. See, America the Beautiful. Just sometimes read the words and imagine what it would be like if that was actually true. All thy good be brotherhood from sea to shining sea. How are you going to do that? There isn't any other way than this. This is the only way you can do that. It is a supernaturally attained fact. And of course, America the Beautiful is phrased as a prayer. This is the only place that we can become fully functional human beings. And that's what holiness means. Holiness just means you naturally do what's right. Not because you're trying to do what's right, but because you're inwardly transformed. Now, I don't have time to develop this morning, but if you will, and I'm not trying to sell books, check it out of the library. But this is one of the themes that we try to develop in the spirit of the disciplines and elsewhere. Is if you want to do what's right, you don't try to do what is right. You become the kind of person who does what is right. It's the same way in every area. You want to play the piano well. You don't try to play the piano well. You become the kind of person who will play the piano well. And that's a different focus. That's a different aim. Now, our focus in all of this has to be on God, and that's where worship comes in. Worship is a matter of ascribing worth. Worth worship. Worthschaft is where this language comes from. It's a matter of ascribing worth. And what we ascribe worth to is the central feature of all of us. That's what pulls everything, what we ascribe worth to. See, that's why, for example, our educational system generally is a failure. It's because the people in it don't ascribe worth to the right things. For example, all over this world, people learn English in the most miserable circumstances. And the reason they do that is because they ascribe great worth to it. And yet in other contexts you have people, for example, language teaching in our country generally is miserable. Not because of the teaching. The teaching is often wonderful. But there's no vision of the worth of learning the language. And that's the only thing that can pull it. And the only thing that can pull what Immanuel Kant called the crooked timber of humanity straight is worship of God. And worship of God has to be based upon truth and conviction. And when we lift God up and worship Him as He is, and we try to do that in our hymns and hopefully in our scripture reading and in many other ways, lifting God up. See, that's an activity. Holiness is an inner condition. Worship is an activity, but it has to be done from an inner direction of truth and reality. So that's one of the dangers of imagination in worship, is that it will be unhooked from truth and reality. And so, for example, when we sing a worship course such as Holiness, Holiness, Holiness is all I long for. Well, is that true? Is that all you long for? Or we sang a song here today, Riches I Heed Not, Nor Man's Empty Praise. See, one of the problems is that because worship is an activity, it can be detached from the inner condition of the heart. And that is where, as the prophet Isaiah said, and Jesus picked it up, "This people are close to me with their lips, but their heart is a way off." See? So when we worship in spirit and in truth. And when we do that, we make contact with God in a way that fills our life with strength and direction and power. And holiness comes forth. The greatest of the disciplines for the present moment is worship. Because when you are in the moment of worship, you're caught up in beauty and strength and power. And that naturally makes you thankful. It makes you hopeful, see, because you see this wonderful, great thing that is God. And we have to be careful now and not mistake imagination only for real worship. And if you want to see a parable for our times, have a check out the movie Sister Act, which is a wonderfully entertaining thing, but when you look at it, you realize it's a parable about our churches. And I'm going to, like my one Aggie joke, I'm going to leave that for you to follow up and think about and wonder as to what it is until you check out and read it. And see what actually happens there and how that church is saved. See, we have to make sure that when we use imagination, and it is a wonderful gift of God, that it is rooted in reality. And if we don't, then we will not worship in spirit and in truth, and we will not make the contact in worshiping that transforms the life. There's a wonderful old hymn by John Newton, "How tedious and tasteless the hours." Any of you know that? One man. "How tedious and tasteless the hours when Jesus no longer I see. Sweet prospects, sweet birds, and sweet flowers have all lost their sweetness to me. The midsummer sun shines but dim. The fields strive in vain to look gay. But when I am happy in him, December's as pleasant as May. Content with beholding his face, my all to his pleasure resigned, no changes in season or place will make any change in my mind. When blessed with a sense of his love, a palace a toy would appear, and prisons would palaces prove, if Jesus would dwell with me there." That's worship. That's real. And it's like we just sink our roots into God when it's real. You know, one of the things that comes out of worship is sin just looks stupid. And you know it really is. That's what it is. Sin is slop. And when we progress in holiness and get beyond the point where we have this idea that, well, we sort of better keep a little sin in reserve because we might need it. You know? Well, I don't really want to give up because I might need it. You see? And how do you get beyond that point? By worship. It's in worship that the reality of God comes home to us. And we just know we don't need that anymore. Now see, it's out of that that absolute solidity of character comes. And it is the vision of God standing before us. You remember David says in Psalm 16:8, "I have set the Lord always before me. He is at my right hand. I will not be moved. And that's the secret of worship and holiness. Well, I hope you'll be able to explore that and bring the beauty of holiness into your life. See, beauty is such an important part of all of this. And think about beauty. Beauty is good becoming sensibly, tangibly present to us. And when you're in the presence of beauty, and especially if you add on to it sublimity and greatness and goodness, as you do in worship, when you add that on, you have a rock on which to live. And your life will be flooded with gratitude. One of Chesterton's clever words, he has so many of them, is one of the most embarrassing moments in the atheist's life is when he feels thankful and has no one to be thankful to. Well, we have someone to be thankful for. Thanks be to God.
Wow, another wonderful, challenging presentation. We're going to have a brief time of Q&A. I have five or six questions here, and I may have lost a couple because I was just stuffing these in my shirt pocket and pants pockets, and I'm not positive I got all of them together this morning. So if your question does not appear, it has not been censored, just ask it from the floor, okay? But I'm going to start with the ones that I do have in hand. We'll start with an easy one and work up to the harder ones to give Dallas a chance to sort of get his rhythm and so forth going on this. If your four-year-old granddaughter were old enough to matriculate in college and sought your advice, where would you suggest that she go?
I get this question all the time, except it isn't with reference to Larissa, but I have just streams of Christian people coming to me at USC and often bringing their daughters because they're considering it, or their sons. And my advice is always go to a school where there's a warm Christian fellowship. And if it's called Christian school and it doesn't have that, don't go to it. And if it's called a secular school and it has that, go to it. Because what's really going to matter for your spiritual life is the fellowship with others who are on the grounds. Now then, I don't just say that because, of course, there's also the issue of the academic excellence of the place, and I try to address that. But I don't think that's really the point of the question.
No. Okay, interesting. Second question. In our culture wars, what is the canon or essential set of books our students should read for a good liberal arts education? Now, that's not such a short question, but I'm sure the sense is if you could suggest several things you think would be particularly key, what would they be? Another question which says essentially the same thing. What four or five books would you say have had a significant impact on the formulation of the ideas you've been expressing in your talks at this conference? In a sense, those are at least related.
Those are really tough questions. I'll try to say something about it. And again, it would depend on where this person was in age and class and all that. I really do think one of the best places to start is Alan Bloom's book, The Closing of the American Mind. And I have written an article called The Unhinging of the American Mind, trying to dig deeper into this, because I think the American mind now is so flabby it can't even close. We're just in really bad shape for critical thinking. Yeah. And one of the ironies is we have these courses in critical thinking, which for the most part simply teach prejudices and how to be politically correct. They don't teach critical thinking. Would to God that they did teach critical thinking. But many of the people think critical thinking means you're criticizing society or something of that sort, you know. And they don't mean you're supposed to be criticizing your own thinking, which would be wonderful if we would do that. But I think Bloom's book really does get you into the middle of this. I've already mentioned Marsden's book. And history is important. Because to know the history of it, and this is one reason why the book I'm writing now on the disappearance of moral knowledge is primarily a history of how we got here. Because when you get to a certain point, there's nothing to do but just tell the story of how you got there and hope people will see. Because you're no longer in a rational argument. So you're not in a rational argument. You're dealing with prejudices, even prejudices about reason itself. But I would suggest that they get a good logic book, perhaps one about 50 years old, and study it carefully. It's tremendously important to do that, and to learn something about logic is helpful. You know, beyond that, it is so hard to say what would be helpful. Read Phil Johnson's stuff. I mean, that's very helpful. Phil is a real gift, partly because he is an excellent logician, and he knows how to hit the tendon and bring out the point and address it. So I would encourage them to read his books. And on the other side, because, you know, we really want people to get a fair hearing on both. That's the only way you can help people. It's just very difficult to know who to recommend, because the people on the other side tend to be so obscure in their writing that you cannot figure out what they're saying. But a good place might be to start with Stanley Fish's article in the current issue of Harper's Magazine. And you read that carefully, and you'll see what he's saying. And he makes the basic point about reason and values, which is there is no way that we can possibly know what real values or truth are, because we all operate from a community of investigation. It's a howlingly invalid argument, but it is the one that has captured the mind.
Yeah, let me...
I would just recommend that they forget about critical thinking and get an older edition of Irving Kopy's Introduction to Logic. And you get an older edition, and one of the things it will do is it will teach you all the informal fallacies, which now many of them aren't regarded as fallacies. For example, the old ad hominem. It's no longer, this is regarded as good logic.
Yeah.
Attack the person.
Well, if there is no truth to be found or no true argument to be won, then it really becomes a matter of being sort of glib, doesn't it?
Yeah, and being and sort of winning in the
yeah
in the back
of in a sort of a
Irving Kopy, C-O-P-I. Irving was a professor of philosophy at Michigan University of Michigan for many, many years. And this was the most widely used and accepted logic text up until, I would say, the mid-70s. Irving Kopy, C-O-P-I, just Introduction to Logic. Don't get his Introduction to Symbolic Logic, at least until after you have gotten rid of it.
More mathematical, it sounds. Reason in the Balance would be, I think, maybe if you were going to pick one of Philip Johnson's books that deals in a more general way with the issues than, say, the details of, say, creation, evolution type stuff. Reason in the Balance is an excellent book for looking at the pervasiveness of naturalism in the academy, in many other disciplines outside of science. So Reason in the Balance would be a good one. Okay. Given that the deep truths of morality are found in Jesus, how or what should we teach about ethics in public universities?
We should simply start with love and make people deny it. I mean, I gave you this wording on one of my little screens, the good heart, and I really recommend you just start there. And you say, now, this is widely understood to be the central ethical principle. And if you get I mentioned someone earlier, Richard Taylor's book, Good and Evil. Now, he is not friendly to a theistic view, but he is a hard, clear thinker. And he basically says the same thing as is in that little screen. See, and you go back, you read Thomas Hobbes, you read John Stuart Mill, you read Immanuel Kant, and one place or another, they all try to claim Jesus. You know? They say, well, now, this is what Jesus is teaching. Well, actually, that's right, see. And I often refer to a book that was a book of ethics, a book called The Field of Ethics, delivered by a man named Palmer at Harvard at the turn of the century, and it was one of the lectureships at Harvard. He writes this book, and at the end he says, now, of course, all we're saying here is simply what Jesus taught. Right. Now, that was said by a Harvard professor. Right. And that is one of the things. In the first chapter of this book I'm writing, I try to bring all that together so that people will see what I call in your notes the Judeo-Christian consensus. Everyone agreed. And now the only question, of course, when philosophers get a hold of something simple like love, they tend to beat it to death to defend their own prejudices. One of the things, good things about Richard Taylor's book is he really doesn't do that. And I think you'll find it very refreshing. The way he writes very clearly, I would really encourage you to look at that if you're interested in how to do it on the campus, the secular campus. And Richard Taylor is well known in philosophy. He's a well-established writer. No one is going to go after him because of his association with God. But he's got it right on with reference to how we make judgments about good and bad persons, and right and wrong actions gets complicated, and then right and wrong institutions, and right and wrong laws. That gets more and more complicated. But at the center of moral worth is the intention to promote human good. And when you pull that out, you lose it.
Okay.
Just to say again, you know, who's going to argue against that?
Yeah.
You know, nobody's going to argue against that because their good sense takes over when you state it bluntly.
Mm-hmm.
And they may quibble a little bit here and there, but you just can't come out against it.
I feel like after 9/11 that evil made a comeback.
Yes, it did.
You know, in the popular psychic.
That's right.
You said the recovery of moral knowledge can lie only through obedience to Jesus Christ, with which I agree. How then, in a pluralistic society where many won't follow Jesus, do we establish laws and government? How do we teach and promote moral knowledge to non-followers of Jesus?
We follow the principle that Jesus laid down, we will have to start with love your neighbor as yourself. Well, if you do that, for example, university life will immediately be transformed. Okay? You have all these people on faculties loving one another as themselves. Can you imagine that? Right. Yeah. I can't either. And the reason you can't imagine it is because it isn't humanly possible. See, that's the next step. When you get people to be clear and straightforward about who we are and what human good really is, the next step, reasonable step, will be reaching out to God. And that will be inevitable because that's the only recourse you have. If you don't set the bar as high as Jesus set it, then you can mess around all your life with stuff and never get anywhere.
Sounds like a good call for a 12-step program for love in the average academic department, right? We need maybe a 14-step program. It's going to be tough. Yeah, 25. Now, I'm through with the questions that I managed to get here with this morning, so if we have some others from the floor, or if you gave me one, you should get priority because I lost it, okay, like a good Aggie. Who gave me a question that I didn't use? Anybody? Yes.
Well, you used my question, but not to my intent.
Oh, okay. Well, I just read it.
You associated it with another question that confused
me. Oh, pardon me.
Okay.
My apologies.
Counted to you in the formulation of your ideas that have been expressed here.
Okay, then I did misinterpret the question.
Well, it's not a long list, but there's some very important ones on it. And frankly, Plato and Aristotle have meant more to me than any other book besides the Bible. They got in on the ground floor. And so they could make a better start. And people after them tend to have to deal with other people who are already on the ground. So then Aquinas and Augustine, they come in from an angle that's different. And when you combine those two, you really get a very fine treatment of the human self, of knowledge, and of human value. And Now, since the medieval period, everyone has been balled up over knowledge. See, that's the big issue, is knowledge. And the effort to reconcile human nature and values with empiricism as a theory of knowledge is what has wrecked the train. Because the human self is not an empirical object. Now, that was not a problem for classical and medieval thought. Well, they said, what else is new? You know, but now we're under the gun, and now then empiricism has turned over into scientism and naturalism, as it's sometimes called, which is even more difficult to deal with. So in the modern period, the one person who has been most helpful to me is a man I mentioned named Edmund Husserl. He's absolutely impossible to read. And now you will find a lot of articles by me about him on my webpage. If you care to go there, I hope they're a little more intelligible. I think they are, and they seem to get appreciation for that. But he is one who sees how to deal with empiricism. He himself was, by the way, he was Jewish, and he was converted to Lutheranism as a graduate student. And all of his life thought of himself as one who was serving God by his work. And, you know, when you read him, you're going to think, well, maybe God can understand it. But his intentions were very right on. And for example, he read the New Testament, gave his little grandson a New Testament with 1 John carefully marked for him to read and so on.
So a translation from English to English. Okay, yes.
It has to do, Dallas, you had mentioned, do Christians actually have something relevant to the particular subjects that the professors have, or than a non-Christian, or are we just nicer? I was wondering if you might have a few more comments, especially for those of us in the technical field.
Yes. Well, this is absolutely fundamental for us. I mean, that's the issue. And now in technical fields, what you have to raise is the question of adequacy of knowledge in your field. Is your knowledge adequate in your field? And there are three ways of thinking about adequacy. One way, can I get by in my professional context? Well, that's easier than the other two. The second is the knowledge in my field, let's say chemistry, adequate to human need? And that's a little harder. And the third way is the knowledge in my field that I teach and the framework in which we work as professionals, is it adequate to its subject matter? That is to say, when you get done and you got your PhD and you're now an accredited person in that field, do you really understand your subject matter? And this is the great challenge. And this is where I believe any thoughtful Christian person is going to say, no, we don't understand it. And we keep looking for more and more clarification. So what? We've got the four basic forces down to three now? Well, when you get them down to one, you're just going to stand before it like a savage before its idol. And you have no idea why that is there. Science will never be able to deal with within what we call science, you'll never be able to deal with two questions. One is, why do the laws that obtain, why are they the laws that obtain? Leibniz said years ago, the laws of mechanics do not explain the laws of mechanics. Why are there those laws? And the second thing that science will never explain, and I say these things hopeful that you who know better will correct me, is why, you see, the application of law always applies, it requires initial conditions to explain anything. If you don't have some conditions, and there is going to be some initial condition, which you will never be able to explain by the laws of science, because they're the condition of you explaining anything else by the laws of science. Those two things, we will always be... Here's another one. Why does mathematics work? That's a real good one. And, of course, in the philosophy of mathematics, people just tie them in knots. But a lot of working mathematicians are really sensitive to that issue and try to say something intelligible about it. How much can be said about it? What needs to be said about it? And then there are many other areas. Why can human beings talk? I mean, don't tell me there's anyone can answer that question. Language is a fundamental mystery. Why are experiences correlated with brain states in the way they are? See, now I know that in all these areas, technical areas, you have strong reductive tendencies that want to get rid of the data which pose the problem. And I understand all that. And I'm just saying that third question of adequacy to subject matter is the really fundamental one. And what we basically get by with is the first one, adequacy to get by in my field and maybe look a little better than the next guy or gal. And they think that we think that's great if we can do that. But that's a far cry from an adequate understanding of the field.
Okay.
Not in detail. I think I mentioned it, I believe, in some of my arguments, but I have not elaborated. I teach it all the time. Those 2 points about what?
Thank you. Those 2 points, because it comes up in philosophy so often, and I'm hopeful that some person more knowledgeable than I will... help me understand better. But I read Stephen Hawking's and Davies and all the other people who try to answer these questions. And it's just, and actually this is not new, because in the 19th century, a man named Dubois Reymond laid out the limits of scientific explanation. And it's been known for a long time. But what happens is when some new development comes along in science, then people jump on that and act as if it were going to explain everything. Right? And so Stephen Hawking starts out his book, A Brief History of Time, talking about how we're going to figure out why we're here. There isn't a thing in the book that explains why we're here. Not a thing. But that's typical. And Stephen Gould and others, they use that same sort of, we're going to do this big thing with this wonderful thing we've got. And, of course, you know by now that if there's any question remaining, evolution will solve it.
In time.
Probably a long time after we're gone. I don't know. I'm going to start here, here, and here. In the moment.
What I'm wondering about is the social context taking away from the purity of worship and why prayer would be more powerful.
Well, let me explain. Yeah, let me explain the point of that remark a little bit. That's why the phrase in the moment is crucial there. In the moment of worship, you stand astonished before what the old hymn calls thy uncreated loveliness. And in that posture, you can't sin. This is the truth in Plato's view, that if you knew the good, you'd have to do it. And you know, I'm sure many of you know that part of the history of thought, is that Socrates, at least, had the view that if you knew the good, you could not do evil. Because he was thinking of it as an intuitive vision of the reality of goodness.
Well,
yeah, you would love it. That's right. But now, for the transformation of character over the long run, worship is not enough. You have to have a lot of things. Regeneration, for one thing. Work of the Holy Spirit. But other disciplines, such as solitude and silence. Fasting is a tremendous discipline for character transformation. And study, of course. Worship, I mentioned, celebration, service, fellowship. All of these things are needed for the full story. So you do need more for character transformation. But in the moment of worship, I think it's simply true. You cannot sin. Now, in the moment of performance of worship, you can. See, and that's, you all know the prophetic theme on that is, get out of here. I don't want to hear any more from you. Don't come spreading your hands in prayer. And that's the part about their lips are close to me, but their heart is far from me. And then Jesus quotes that passage in Mark 7 and adds, you substitute the traditions of men for the commandments of God. And then we're in real trouble. Yes.
Over the past several days, I've observed you as a teacher, and I've noticed some traits which I think you have modeled for us. First, you take words very seriously. Second, personhood is central to your thinking.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
And third, you have an educational aim, a telos, that supersedes disciplinary focus. I'm an oddball here, and I'm greatly encouraged by all these brothers and sisters who are teaching at secular universities. I teach at a Christian college.
Mm-hmm.
My greatest concern is that with regard to these concerns that you have, caring for words, personhood, and a clear educational aim, I don't see it in many of the students who are Christian who come to my Christian college. And I wonder why. I wonder if you could address that. It seems to me that even the church, which is our great hope, is influenced by a consumer attitude, utilitarian values for education that thwart personhood, so many theological views of toxicity with regard to the self. Sin is stronger than God's proclamation of goodness mm-hmm. of creation. How do we deal with these concerns, even within our fold, the church?
I'm going to follow Mary Poplin now and ask if the tape is running. I thought that was great, Mary. Well, basically, I think the question is how, with the consumerist attitude in education, can you be faithful to the values of intellect and education and art, and in particular, care about persons, care about words, and so on. I would say I love words, and I love persons. And I know that you can't love one without loving the other. So, I don't know. I think that in a sense, a Christian academic is like a minister in this regard. That they have a platform to stand on, which can rise above consumerism. Now, whether they do or not is another issue. And of course, if you're in a Christian school, there are real consumerist problems here. Because the consumer group is smaller, and the appeal is sometimes harder. And I'm going to say something now that could offend many people. The Christian college movement, as we know it now, was a reactionary movement against the failure of Christianity in the colleges that have now departed. And frankly, the aim of that movement was not education. It was protection. And we have not overcome that. So, for example, artistic creativity is genuinely threatening. And the free use of intellect, academic freedom, in the right sense, is threatening. And treating young people as persons who have to be developed by letting them run and staying with them, rather than saying, you can't go beyond that. See, that's very threatening. And and of course, then most of the non-Christian schools just err in the opposite direction and say anything you run is good because you're running. See, and so now can we have a framework of values and understanding that will enable administrators in Christian schools and secular schools to exercise a role of direction that permits us to love the good and to let people be free in the confidence that the good will rein them in because we know it in our own lives? That's the challenge. This gentleman and then here. Yes.
And about how Christians have advocated the arts.
Mm-hmm.
And I appreciate that because in the early part of the last century, Christians were so intensely fighting the low view of Jesus' deity that they compromised in many ways to not hold in tension his full humanity. So how can we correct that imbalance without being reactionary? Is there some things we can focus on, resources?
Yeah, it's another. We live under the hand of that reaction in so many ways. The question is basically, how can we today do justice to the humanity of Jesus in a period where we have had to defend his deity so strongly that we lose it? And I don't think there's any recourse to this except to do justice to the tradition of this discussion in the church and to go through all the docetism and the other problems with the body. And I think we have to have a really strong view that flesh is good. And I put it that way because this is exactly what you're up against, is the idea it's bad. So the New International Version, whose problems are very far from being just what are they going to do about gender, because that version mistranslates much of the scripture, including the word sarx, and translates it as fallen human nature. And this is a part of our problem. So to be able to say, no, the flesh is good, it has to be in its place. And it is good as a dwelling place of God. That's the incarnationist point, is not about Jesus only. It's about human nature as well, and the continuing incarnation of Christ in his people. And this is really a huge doctrinal discussion. And I think the best way to do it is to look at how it was fought out in the past. I mean, Mary was one of the great important things about Mary in the history of the church was she knew that Jesus had a body. And that was very important because right after the events of death and resurrection and so on, I mean, your head would have been swimming too in that context. I mean, was this a, we might say, a hologram or some sort of thing? What was that? I mean, it went right through the wall. Did you see that? And then they remember things like how he kind of got about and knew things while he was before his resurrection. So this is a huge issue, and I think the answer is study the Christian tradition on it and then bring it up to date. And I think that will help. But this actually is related to your question too. I mean, so these are crucial for us. Now then we need to go back and say, here's what's wrong with pornography. Here's what's wrong with degrading sex. Here's what's wrong with identifying yourself in terms of your sexual preference, as we now say. If I come to your town, I hope you won't introduce me as one of the world's leading heterosexuals. Yeah. I hope you won't. Right. Yes.
Several times in the last few days you've mentioned speakers, especially philosophers, whom you say are remarkable for their teachings, but then you say they are unreadable.
Mm-hmm.
This is a dilemma of mine. I am in English literature.
Right.
I would love to read philosophy and psychology. There are so few whom I can understand. I feel out of my depth in my own field because I cannot read the French rationalists. And my conviction is that people who are unreadable have a major failure of soul and spirit.
That's right.
That they are hiding behind
something. That's right. Absolutely right.
As a consequence, my escape, yeah. The only way I can survive is English literature and poetry and the visual arts and music. Of course, those become defiled too, as strongly in my church as on the university campus often.
Mm-hmm.
And so I'm not sure how to articulate my question, but...
Well, one of the things... No.
My students read some of these things and they come away high, but you know, I believe that my students don't know what they're talking about. And these guys are not a language that none of them understand.
No, I mean, that connection is absolutely right. Because what you're, if you work your way into the phenomena of kingdoms and human kingdoms and not just the kingdom of God, I think you'll see how this works. For example, what you're addressing is the same as language in a gang. See, if you're going to be a gang, you have to create a language. Because that's the way you exclude others and assure yourself of uniqueness and some sort of special position. And then, of course, you're unintelligible, but that is regarded as an advantage. And now, by the way, I will say, if you read that book of Richard Taylor's on good and evil, I think you're going to find it just beautifully intelligible, because Richard was a person who thought he was supposed to talk to people clearly. And he was also a very hard-nosed guy who wasn't afraid to be understood. And but now that's a real problem in our academic culture, and it is a part of the defining of the professoriate as a social class, and then within that, the continuing redefinition of finer and finer divisions. You know, what that means is, for example, my own colleagues will not try to evaluate my work; they'll get someone from another university who's supposed to understand it. Well, I don't like that. I wish they would evaluate it. But many times they won't even read it because they say, well, you know, it's not my specialization, and so forth and so on. So, you see, the biggest threat to the kingdom of God in my life is my kingdom. And the great temptation is to build that moat and put the alligators in it and be secure. And communication means others can get at you. And so we have these people building these walls and usually dying from terminal loneliness also at the same time. So I think we can stand for something here as Christians if we stand in the kingdom of God. And very simply say, no, we can write clearly. We can write where people who will put forth a modest effort can understand it. Now, it is true that if, in at least in philosophy, if you're too easily understood, it is not thought to be a mark of intelligence. I think this gentleman here, and then we'll come back to you.
What you just said about people in your own department not being willing to read your work, I mean, I think this is characteristic of the sciences as well. When I was teaching, I mean, I know that my real peers were that scattered at
right.
around the world.
Right.
There were very few.
Mm-hmm.
We don't this idea of integrating knowledge and being able to speak across these narrow boundaries is very rarely encouraged within the university. So we
very rarely.
Yeah. Other colleges.
Right. But it isn't because it's impossible. It's because there's no reward attached to it, number one. There's danger attached to it, number two. And there's no will for it. Wendell Berry, I don't know if you know Wendell Berry, but Wendell Berry has a wonderful article on how the university was lost. And I'm sorry I can't give you a reference to it, but he really addresses these issues and the responsibility that we have to not go this route. And I think he does an excellent job of... Now, of course, doing anything about it, if you try to do anything about it, you'll be very threatening to your colleagues because they're comfortable where they are. They like their kingdom. So it's a problem. This lady back here. Well, I think how can we help at the secondary level to have kids who go off to college more capable of thinking, more open? You can do a lot. Of course, much depends on the circumstances. For example, how many kids are you trying to teach? How much help do you have from parents? What kind of support do you get from your principal? But you can do an awful lot for kids. Just by selecting what they read, not necessarily long books, though sometimes that's okay too, but carefully chosen articles that will make them think and then make them write, and teach them how to take a piece of language and thought apart and put it back together and evaluate it. And most young people are intelligent enough to do that, but they don't have someone who is encouraging them by giving them things to work on that they will get their teeth into and say, hey, this is great. I frankly recommend a little bit of Orwell, for example. Orwell's a wonderful writer. He has a piece on, I think, killing an elephant or something.
Shooting
an elephant. Wonderful piece of work. And it's not long, it's hard to read. So if I had to pick one genre, I would say teach them the essay. And let them read Bacon and Montaigne. And then come up to some of the moderns. Because that genre is beautiful for forming the mind and the soul. I think we can do a lot. I taught high school myself many years ago. It was a different world. But I so enjoyed being able to work with young people at that age because their minds are wonderfully free and active if you can catch them just right. And they remain a little bit of that. You know the difference between a graduate and an undergraduate student, don't you? When the professor walks in and says, good morning, the undergraduates say, good morning. graduate students write it down. It's hard to reach them at that point because they're so obsessed with things.
One more question. This will be the last one.
How about two? Just real quick. I'll answer quick. Yes.
I guess speaking about clarity and depth, I was sort of surprised you would recommend Lewis or Chesterton.
I'll tell you why I don't recommend them. I think that what they do is almost unteachable. What they do is so beautiful, it is so powerful, that they will distract you from how they do it. And one of the things I learned beginning to teach was, I don't do my students a lot of good to go in and, as we say, snow them. Chesterton just blows me away. And Lewis is the same way. They are so clever, they are so good, and you cannot teach people to do that. Right. I mean, within limits, you can teach people to do what Michael Jordan did, but it's limited. See? Now, you can probably teach them to do what Scottie Pippen did, but not what Michael did. And that's the way I feel about them. They're wonderful to read, but not for the purpose that the lady was addressing. And that's why I don't. And if someone knows better than me on that, I would say fine. Last question.
Dallas, you never really told us much about yourself, and I think...
I thought he was going to say, I never told the Aggie joke.
There's probably not enough time, but maybe, is there more information on... You just said you were a high school teacher. Fascinating. And,
I loved it. Taught English literature, algebra. Wonderful. Yeah. There's some stuff on my webpage, but, the reason is I don't think it's very interesting.
That
reminds me of, the wonderful Churchill thing where I think someone said, Attlee, who was it? It was the guy that tried to negotiate with Hitler.
Neville Chamberlain.
Someone said to Churchill, Chamberlain is so humble. And Churchill replied, well, but then he has so much to be humbled about.